Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. First, a little housekeeping. The Recovery Cast is a bi-weekly podcast series that you can find on the web at myrecoverycast.com. My name is Ron, and my partner in this effort is Dave. The Recovery Cast is not affiliated with any program and does not speak for anyone or offer the definitive view on anything. We are simply two addicts in recovery seeking to provide some, I guess you would call it, infotainment to others in recovery, with a particular emphasis on the Narcotics Anonymous experience, history, and culture. Today's episode is the second in a series of interviews we're doing with Boyd and Chris, who are researchers who have devoted considerable time, effort, and discipline to the history of the 12-step programs. They have worked on a few projects under the direction of William White, author of the book Slaying the Dragon, and numerous scholarly pieces on any number of topics related to recovery from addiction. Try Googling William White Narcotics Anonymous to see this body of really excellent work. Our last episode in this series focused on the roots of NA, tracing them back to the Addicts Anonymous group in the Lexington Hospital in the 1940s, and discussing the various ways those roots sprouted during that period, including the NA Fellowship that formed in 1953 in Southern California by a group of AA members. This time, we focus on the period 1953 through 1979 or so, jumping out of that box here and there when the discussion led us there. This conversation actually lasted about 3 hours, so we'll give you an hour of it now and follow up later with another episode taken from this same interview. Last time we were talking about the Danny Carlson version of NA, we'll call it that, and the Jimmy Kennan version. Maybe we can use that just as language to help us keep them distinct. In the Danny Carlson version, or affiliated with, I think, was somebody in Canada starting out in Windsor, Ontario, and I think she moved around Ontario, named Lynn A., who had some correspondence with Bill. Chris, can you tell us about her and some of that correspondence with Bill Wilson?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. One of the things that we talked about in the last interview was about Danny Carlson and this question about whether he'd ever been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so there's a 1951 newspaper article in the Lawrence Journal World, which is a Kansas newspaper, called Addicts Saved by Anonymous Group. And in the article, it says, quote, after Danny's seventh cure and introduction to the Addicts Anonymous Group in the hospital, he was just discharged. He quickly hooked onto an Alcoholics Anonymous group in New York City, but soon had slipped back into drug taking again. Then I knew there had to be something special like NA for me on the outside, he said. As soon as I got through the next cure, I started to work. And what's interesting about this is this kind of question that comes up during this era of where should the addict go to get help? And, you know, Betty T. with the Habit Forming Drugs Group had the belief that addicts needed to find recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we kind of talked a little bit about this. And this woman, Lynn A., in Montreal, as we'll talk about, had some different views as well. What we know about Lynn is that she stopped using narcotic drugs in March of 1951, which she describes as having had a spiritual experience or a religious conversion when she was in the county jail in Windsor. She ends up moving to Montreal in November of 54 and finds two other, what she calls ex-addicts who are attending Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. She has a little bit of literature that Danny Carlson had sent her, but had no intention of trying to start an NA group there. One of these ex-addicts was a psychiatrist, and she calls Lynn to say that perhaps they have enough now to start an NA group and that they should hold meetings in his apartment. So the first meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, the New York, early New York version, is held December 23rd, 1954, with two people attending. And by February of 55, they start having meetings at a classroom at Loyola College where an Alcoholics Anonymous group had met for 14 years. But what becomes interesting is that she starts communicating with Bill about literature, you know, and about a kind of an all-inclusive program, not just for addicts, but for alcoholics as well. She had taken chapter 5 from the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, How It Works, and she starts to make some changes to it. For instance, they say, we admitted we were addicts and that our lives had become unmanageable. One of the things that they decided to add, they kind of put at the end of the draft and said that they were going to move it up to the front of the draft. And it is that it is our experience that once we have lost our tolerance for any given drug or chemical, we have usually lost our tolerance for them all. So it was kind of talking about that risk for, or that need for total abstinence. She makes some notes in the edges of the How It Works chapter. She's referencing this part of How It Works where it talks about step 4. And so the body or the content of How It Works is, next we launched out a course of vigorous house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. And then she has some notes in the side of this where she says, most addicts are afraid to even begin on this one. So she's kind of saying that this idea of vigorous house cleaning, the step 4 that's being recommended, that addicts are afraid to endeavor into this. And so she's talking about trying to make some changes to that section of How It Works.
It's interesting that kind of also echoes some of Bill's sentiment from the time when he, in that other set of letters with Jack P, where he was basically saying, you know, those poor devils, you know, talking about addicts, it's very difficult for them to get enough character for these steps to actually work, which I think all those notions we have been quite disabused of by now with addicts working the steps in Narcotics Anonymous. Here is a more extended quote than we shared last time, taken from a 1952 letter from Bill Wilson to Jack P., an AA member from the Los Angeles area, who was trying to figure out how to help addicts in the L.A. County Jail at the request of the sheriff. As we discussed in our last interview with Boyd and Chris, Jack showed up at Jimmy's Memorial in 1985 and shared the story of these pre-1953 beginnings. Boyd and Chris found this correspondence between Bill and Jack in the AA General Service Office archives in New York. Bill says in the letter dated August 11, 1952, quote, there is no doubt that in time the AA message will filter over into these poor devils and liberate a great many of them. And a little later, quote, another difficulty you will have is this. Apparently, morphine and its derivatives does such terrific things to the honesty department that it's hard to get a sound moral area into which the AA program can be introduced. Dope has made these otherwise fine people so phony that it's hard to make a beginning. But I was told years ago by Dr. Lawrence Kolb, former Assistant Surgeon General who built the Lexington Hospital, that if an addict were confined for, say, 6 months to a year, then the moral faculties could return in many cases. At this point, they would be quite amenable to the AA approach. But as Dr. Cole points out, such confinement would have to be absolute proof against narcotics being sold in the place. A slip could easily take a man back to where he had once been before. So one of the difficulties you will encounter is that of insulating these people from the narcotics long enough for them to regain their sanity so that AA can be given to them. But by all means try, and keep me posted on how you're getting along. Wow. But back to today's story. Chris goes on to further describe the correspondence between Lynn A. from Montreal and Bill Wilson.
So she points out to Bill that an alcohol addict is still an addict, and she proposes creating something, again, using language that's already been around, but she proposes creating an Addicts Anonymous and suggests to Bill Wilson that he spearhead this effort, including writing a new book that could result in, quote, a new salvation for hundreds more who are only your blood brothers anyhow. Bill responds by drawing upon the experience of Betty with the habit-forming drugs group, and he says he's never seen her be able to make addicts into AA members. And one of the famous quotes that Bill has in his comparison of alcoholics and addicts is that he says that there's an almost inexplainable distrust and dislike of alcoholics and addicts for each other. She goes on to say that I have, quote, I have no quarrel with AA. It is by these means that I came into NA proper myself. I do not understand what you mean about the existing antipathy between the alcoholic and the drug addict. She says, with us, we have even changed the first step to say we admitted that we were addicts, simply so that the addicted or newcomer may immediately associate himself with the program. I found that it is almost impossible to tell a man who has just laid down his hypodermic needle, etc., that his trouble is booze. Instead, we work from the angle that alcohol is a narcotic.
Well, what I found really fascinating about that exchange between Lynn and Bill is she sort of takes him on. She takes him on in a spunky kind of way at some point. And there's one quote where she says, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that alcoholism is addiction to alcohol. It is addiction that is the problem, not the chemical or the drug that the person is addicted to. And this was in March of 1957. And we know she was affiliated with the Danny Carlson school, not the Jimmy Kay strain, but her philosophy, if you will, her kind of theoretical look at the steps was really consistent with what Jimmy was up to. She was trying for language also that where she was saying, as you said, we admitted we were addicts, right? That's the way she worded the first step. Whereas Jimmy and company worded it, we admitted we were powerless over our addiction. And I believe that Danny's first step was we admitted we were powerless over narcotics, correct?
No, I think it's drugs.
Yeah, drugs? I think it's drugs.
Okay.
Drugs, we're powerless over drugs, which is the substance as opposed to the condition. I mean, you're right, Ron. I agree with you. Both Lynn A. and Jimmy just kind of nail it.
Well, I think I might have mentioned to you last time, you guys, when you dug this stuff up, you sent it to me to look at, and I happened to receive it when I was in Canada and about to give a history presentation at the Canadian National Convention. And so I quickly started messing with my PowerPoint because I thought, holy cow, these guys are going to really enjoy hearing this sort of forward-thinking a woman from Canada who really had something going on, an office, a board, was working on a book. Do we know, did that ever get absorbed into the Jimmy Kay NA family, or did it go away, or what do we know about that?
I think it's unknown, but I want to say that you're right about her spunk, and I just want to read one paragraph from a letter that's from that March 57 letter. She says, but darn it, Bill, just try to see what I'm getting at for a second. I know, too, that you are only addicted to alcohol, so it is hard for you to see yourself as an addict. And being an alcoholic means your very life to you now. If someone has called you an alcoholic or an addict 30 years ago, it wouldn't have meant one damn to you. But it would have meant a very great deal to those who associate themselves with the word addict. That's really all I'm trying to get across to you. I can see for myself right now that this is a hopeless cause, and I would not want to see anything happen to a bunch of alcoholics who insisted on being called alcoholics to recover. This is all that would really be required to throw the doors wide open to hundreds of so-called junkers and habitual addicts. Honest to God, Bill.
Man, she was really going after it. And, you know, I can just picture Bill reading that after he's been in this kind of dogged back and forth with Betty Tom all along, and she's just not having it either. And finally, like you said in the last interview we did, he finally just puts his foot down and says, you know, we've got to write something that just spells this out.
But let me say this. I do admire her spunk. And in a way, what she was doing was using Bill's words against him. And in the doctor's opinion, which is really the first paragraph of the big book about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sure it was written by Bill, in introducing Dr. Silkworth's letter, he says, a well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. And then Dr. Silkworth goes on three times in that letter to use the term alcoholic addiction. So it certainly wasn't the first time he heard that.
Right.
You know, when I listen to Bill's response, or when I read Bill's responses, I do get what he's saying, though. He's saying you might be able to make that case on some kind of principle, but he says that there is a cultural barrier. When you try to mix addicts and alcoholics, this was his take at the time, whether true or not, probably his experience also, that when you try to mix them, you get this self-image that each group has, that we are different than the other group. And he's saying you're basically buying a whole division and disunity that you don't need. And he was, and his solution instead was to say, here, take the 12 steps and create the program yourself. And they were never strict about intellectual property. They basically gave it away, allowed it to be, you know, they're concerned about making sure you attribute it properly and all of that, but they weren't concerned about, you know, royalties or anything like that. They just allowed NA to, and other groups, to just modify them.
Well, I think they did NA a great, he did NA a great favor as well by creating this situation where a separate fellowship had to arise out of this. It was very clear that they were not going to be assimilated into AA without some difficulty.
As far as I'm concerned, there's an irony in a certain type of AA member is quite open to addicts being in their meetings. And you would think that's the progressive kind of open-minded one. And then there's the old timer who says, we want to really stick to our singleness of purpose and we don't want addicts in our meetings. And here in Albuquerque, there's stories of people going, old timers going up to the whiteboard at the back of the room and writing no addicts exclamation point. And you know, the result, the interesting effect of that is, Albuquerque had a very strong NA community very early because addicts couldn't just go and blend in at AA and say the passwords. They would get basically booted out. But the interesting dynamic I was sort of getting at is that, like, if you go to a little NA community in the middle, Podunk, USA, where all the addicts go to AA, the NA community is very, very weak often. And then the word in the AA is, well, you better come to AA because that NA meeting is so weak. And as long as they keep going to AA, the NA meeting stays
weak
until you get people in the NA meeting saying, like I did, I remember kind of taking a deep breath and doing this way back and just saying, if I'm going to say to the NA newcomer, keep coming back, it works, then I better know it works. And if I know, the only way I'm going to know it works is if I'm getting it right here in NA and I stop going to AA, which is kind of a big, big decision back in the early 80s when the idea of going to just NA was still a little bit difficult to have faith in.
One thing I want to add about Lynn A that's interesting is the proposed book title that she was talking about for this book. She says, I'm calling it Recovery from Addiction, which seemed like a pretty progressive title.
Yes.
For 1957.
Everything about Lynn A was quite progressive, quite forward thinking. Lynn A is sort of an auspicious name in NA history, right? Because there was also the woman from upstate New York.
From Rochester, New York, I believe. It was, went out and was Jimmy's secretary for a while and flew back and forth.
One other thing that I want to touch on, and we got a lot of other ground to cover, but in this early period is, we alluded a little bit to the possible relationship of some kind between Danny and Jimmy Kay. Do you recall that?
Yeah. Actually, I do. This is from a 1984 interview with Gene H. and Jimmy. And this is Jimmy speaking. So Danny was in Lexington, and he had gone to some AA meetings, and he had got much of the same idea. And again, they developed that into a point where they were different from us. And what I didn't like was, when I wrote to Danny, there were no groups. There wasn't even a group except that they would get together and hold a group. There was nothing standard.
The letter, the response that they got was written like January 52, like the January 2nd maybe. So it leads you to believe that they had to have written kind of towards the end of 51.
Let's kind of focus in now on the 1953 group, and sort of, you know, we know that there's this relationship between Jimmy and Cy that sort of becomes a big part of the story, that they have two different kind of approaches that they take, and that there's probably a personality clash between them. So maybe we should take it up from there. How many people are involved in that really early 1953 group in Southern California?
One of the amazing things that we were able to get from the NA World Service Archives was a document that showed kind of the date of really kind of like the first 30 meetings or so, and the attendance total, what was collected from the seventh tradition, and what the expenses were, what the amount of the expenses were, and then who chaired the meeting, or who they had listed as the leader of the meeting. So from that, what we could say is that from October 5th, 1953 through May 17th, 1954, you roughly have about 16 unique individuals. And this is without Jimmy's name being involved. These are 16 unique individuals who chair or lead that weekly Monday night NA meeting. And the average attendance was about 17 per meeting, with a high of 35 and a low of 5.
Let's talk about Cy for a while. Let's just try to get him in focus a bit. What can you tell us about him?
What we can tell you that's interesting is that he was born February 26, 1907 in Philadelphia. So like Jimmy, you know, he spent time in Philadelphia growing up. And he passed away January 12, 1971 in North Hollywood in California. And he's buried in Valhalla Memorial Park. But he was a baseball player. He pitched for the South Philadelphia Hebrew Association from 1925 to 1926. He pitched for some other places professionally. He pitched in the Eastern Shore League. And then he signed with the Philadelphia Phillies in 1928 in their minor league system. And he made his only major league appearance with the Phillies August 17, 1934. He enlists in the Navy in December 41 after Pearl Harbor. And while he's in the Navy, a gun mount swung around and broke his neck and back. And this is where he becomes addicted to more. He's prescribed morphine, which he finds himself being addicted to. And then he turns to alcohol to help ease off of the morphine. And so there's a quote that says, fearing that he was becoming a drug addict, turned to alcohol. And the combination actually turned out to be a godsend in his case. He went to no more hospitals, no rest homes, but by sheer willpower shed himself of both habits. It you know, he's described in this article as being the originator of Narcotics Anonymous.
And that seems to, he seems to have presented himself as the founder of Narcotics Anonymous in a few places. When he's interviewed, they introduce him as the founder of NA.
In one of the write-ups, about him. It says it became a regular speaker at California prisons. And a drug addicted inmate at San Quentin said of Psy that, quote, he is the best friend we dope fiends have. And boy, do you want to talk a little bit about what the Gene H interview tells us?
What I remember about it was, is Jimmy telling Gene that Psy called him up and he was thinking it was the latter part of 59. And asked Jimmy if he could meet him over at the church, and Jimmy said sure, and they met, and Cy gave him the keys and what they had left of, you know, whether it was literature, money, or neither, and just said, you know, I've got to go on location, so I can't be doing this anymore, and would you please take over? And so that was kind of the time where, and they almost folded. And, you know, there's a little bit of discrepancy. We don't know how long there was before Jimmy decided to get with Sylvia and pick it back up. And maybe it was Jimmy and friends who did it. But, you know, I've seen things as little as 3 weeks, and some people say 3 months. So, you know, there's nothing substantiated about that. But we do know that there was certainly a dip in meetings and in leadership at that time, because it was at that time that Jimmy said he talked with Sylvia, and Sylvia says, well, you know, I can't go to AA, and Jimmy says, well, a lot of people can't, and we want to start this thing over, and we want to do it just like we did it from the beginning. We want to stick by the traditions.
You know, it tells us in that interview that, you know, Jimmy says, you know, that they stopped following the traditions. You know, he describes Psy as being hard-nosed. And he says that Psy used to make statements at the AA meeting to the group that he would say, oh, let these addicts and these other people find another place to go. AA is for alcoholics, and that's what it is. And Jimmy says, so he was hard-nosed that way, but Psy was a hard-nosed. Let's face it. A lot like ourselves, he was going to do things his way, God damn it.
And I think that you could say that the general drift, sort of the popular story that we hear, is that Psy and Jimmy had a fairly strong personality conflict, and that kind of the event that caused the controversy in the end, that approaching 1959, was Psy did an interview with some media in which he, A, broke his anonymity, and I think B, you know, referred to himself as the founder or the leader of NA or something. And this caused such controversy that it nearly destroyed the group, and that he eventually walked away. And that was that 1959 thing.
I think what's real important is that the leadership changed and that the focus changed. Because in my humble opinion, and Chris's also, it's at, and probably a lot of other people too, it's at this very, very point when Jimmy and friends take back over in late 59, early 60, and adhere to the traditions, that we actually come to the modern NA.
Okay, so things get started back up in the 60s. And the 60s, I sort of associate the period of the 50s with a single meeting, some people with a vision, but basically a small meeting in Southern California and a small NA community that experienced some divisions that kind of came to a head in 1959. 1960, when they start back up, Psy is not involved anymore. Is that true?
That's correct. Let me ask something, Ron. Can we backtrack into 57 a little bit and talk about the Soledad pamphlet?
Just a brief introduction, since we jumped right into this. The Soledad pamphlet, as the name implies, is a piece of literature developed in the Soledad prison in California, we believe in 1957. It's particularly interesting to try to place this piece in the puzzle of emerging NA influences at the time. There is evidence, as you will see, of Addicts Anonymous influence out of Lexington, Southern California NA influence, likely from Jimmy Kay, Though this is the period in which most accounts say he had stepped back from the meeting for a bit, and Danny Carlson's influence as well, though Danny had died the year before. The leadership of that NA movement had been assumed by Ray Lopez. We'll explore all of that now, like the four history nerds we are, picking over every aspect of this artifact of NA history.
Yeah, it's actually a little bit of an anomaly, because it really looks like Jimmy's handwriting on there that says 1957 on Soledad pamphlet, or booklet is what it is. But it really, it's the first thing I see that's got NA on it that has the traditions in it. And it's also got the powers over addiction, which we surmise was actually written in 54 in the original Buff book. Jimmy and Cy argued about this. Cy wanted either narcotics or drugs, and Jimmy said no, he wanted addiction. And obviously, eventually, Jimmy won out on that. And, you know, much to Jimmy's credit, I mean, that opened the door for everything. And so we now we see it in the Buff book, which is published in 54 and is distributed among just Southern California right there, San Fernando Valley, probably. And then we see it in Soledad. We see the wording in Soledad the first time it appears. But yet we found no type of correspondence or anything that assumes that Jimmy and Cy or any of those people had, had contact. But Ron, you have a wonderful story about talking with Jimmy about that I'd love to hear.
Well, you're talking about the phrasing, we admitted that we were powerless over our addiction, as opposed to we admitted that we were powerless over and then named the substance or a group of substances.
And correct. That's exactly it. Yes.
Yeah. So I moved to Southern California in 84, very end of 84. I was there by January of 85. I had been working for the World Service Office since July of 84, but I was working from home in Fargo for the first 5 months. And when I got to Southern California, my home group was the Sunday night Burbank meeting. And so in 1985, when Jimmy was going around and taking his last, what was going to be his last cakes for his 35th anniversary, he came to our home group. And before then, I had known Jimmy. You know, I wasn't sure he'd even remember me, because it was the kind of thing where I'm in the hinterlands of NA and I'm calling and talking to Jimmy to get literature, and he's given us his coaching about our group and how to run our group and all of that stuff. Well, by then I was really interested in this thing. How did we get to that language, powerless over our addiction? And so I sat down, Jimmy and I were sitting together in the back of the room after the meeting was all over and just talking. And, you know, yeah, dear, I found out, yeah, he remembered me from those days in Fargo. And I asked him this question: did you guys actually know how significant it was going to become? Or did you sort of back into that language and then it became significant later? And his answer was, no, we tried out everything. We tried different phrasing, different wordings. And when we hit on that one, this is it. This is the one. And, I came away from that going, that's probably true. I guess I was young and cocky. I was a little bit of a skeptic. I thought maybe those old guys didn't, backed into it or whatever. But no, Jimmy said it was a very deliberate decision. But if you look at this Soledad one, it's got a couple of differences. For one thing, the way of life phrase is very prominent in it, way of life, which I associate with kind of the Danny Carlson et al. There was a piece of literature, Our Way of Life, which was written by the Addicts Anonymous in Lexington. If you look at this Soledad stuff and you try to kind of think about it in terms of its roots. It's very AA oriented. It doesn't say over our addiction, for one thing, like the NA does. It says we admitted we were powerless over addiction. So it generalizes it more, where the first step of NA focuses it right on myself. I admit I'm powerless over my addiction. And the word we is missing from the beginning of all the steps. And then when you get to the end, it says, you know, practices, principles in all our affairs. Quite in order, isn't it? But do not be discouraged. Does that have a familiar ring to it?
Absolutely.
That's the basically a slight paraphrase of the AA after how it works. It says, Narcotics Anonymous is not a religion. It is a way of life. And the "it is a way of life" is in all caps. So I just think I can see a little Addicts Anonymous in there. I can see a little AA in there. And as you say, you didn't say it, but Boyd, when you were talking about that cover, the cover has the stylized NA kind of curved the way our NA logo looks today with the circle around it. And then it's got the kind of the picture of the steps curved around it, which I've seen that image a couple of times in our stuff, I think. Maybe it was this pamphlet, I don't know. But so you can see influences from all around, but it isn't clearly aligned with anything that I can tell. I found that the traditions in the Soledad piece were interesting too, that they're, well, some of them are exactly the same. And then the fourth tradition, our group should be self-sustaining, except in matters affecting other groups or NA as a whole, which is, I don't know if it was an intentional, maybe they were saying, well, nobody knows what autonomous means, let's describe it. But they didn't really describe it very well. Self-sustaining is more like the seventh tradition. Autonomous has to do more like with the independent self-governing. The fifth tradition, they refer to carry its message to the narcotic who is still suffering and wants to quit using. So interesting, just some language differences there that are a little hard to understand why they took that tack.
But I think that's got to do with the time frame, Ron, is because I've read in the Jack P. interview, as a matter of fact, is that of that time in the 50s, you know, that is what somebody that was addicted to opiates was called, was a narcotic. Although we don't really look at it that way this day currently, back in the day, that was very common language.
Yeah, I did notice that in the Jack P. interview and also in the Jack P. correspondence with Bill. When Bill spoke of addicts, he called us narcotics.
Tradition 8 is also interesting in that, in addition to remaining non-professional, that they welcome assistance of the institutional sponsorship and all others who may have information on our problem. And, you know, prison-based or institutional-based NA groups always have these kind of unique issues that they have to deal with, particularly when you're kind of looking at autonomy and so forth and the influence of, you know, the kind of the institution that they're in.
So it appears to me that this Soledad thing was really a thing unto itself, right? It was inside of a prison, but we find it so interesting because it occurred in 1957 or in the 1950s at the time when NA was in its infancy in Southern California. But it wasn't, I wouldn't necessarily place it as as affiliated with anything else, really. It was attempting, it looks to me just from looking at it, like it was attempting to do something like so many others were doing, like we talked about in our last interview where you were saying you get these multiple iterations of different people trying to copy an innovation. It seems to fit more in that pattern than a affiliate of NA. All right, so the 1960s. It was in the 60s that all the things that we read at the meetings, or most of the things that we read at the meetings now were written, like who is an addict, what is the NA program. And Jimmy, I was surprised to see that I thought that there was a few other authors with some of that stuff, but it looks like Jimmy wrote all of those. Is that correct?
On the ones that I've seen, the answer is yes.
In 1960, New Literatures created Who's an Addict by Jimmy Kay, What is the Narcotics Anonymous Program by Jimmy Kay and Sylvia W. Why Are We Here is written by Jimmy Kay and Sylvia W. And then Jimmy wrote the How It Works, What Can I Do in Recovery and Relapse. We see him later in 1961 writing We Do Recover.
So, you know, when I hear you say that, there's this whole issue of the founder, you know, and it just seems to me it's pretty justified identifying Jimmy Kay as the founder. And we're not trying to say the definitive word on anything here, just kind of ruminating out loud. But, I mean, he's pretty much accepted to be the founder. And then there's those who say, well, why do we say a single person is a founder when a group of people founded it? And Jimmy himself was always sort of out of an abundance of humility on the topic. He would say NA was founded by a group of people. But when you start looking at that, when you start looking at the phrase powerless over our addiction being attributed to him, all of those readings, when it kind of came back together in 1960, and then they began to write these readings, Who is an Addict? What is the NA program? How it works? That it's more than just the fact that he played a leadership role during all those years. He, in fact, authored the core pieces of literature that make the foundation of NA today, sounds to me like.
I would add to that he was extremely instrumental in supporting the formation of NA around the world in other communities, in other countries. We see correspondence from 1962 with Australia. We see him communicating with people in Canada in 62. And we've heard a lot of anecdotal stories of people who got into recovery contacting Jimmy and saying things like, I need to come to California to become part of NA, and him saying, no, stay in Nebraska and start NA there. And he did a lot of things to record meetings on tape, to provide as much information as he could to people so that they could hear what a meeting sounded like, so that they could get a feel for what was the culture and structure of a Narcotics Anonymous group and meeting.
And you know, I can speak from firsthand experience and say that being a guy out in a small NA community in a pretty remote area, I had a little white book in my hand with the phone number on it. And when you called that phone number, Jimmy answered that phone. And how many people in all over the fellowship have that story? That Jimmy was shepherding this fellowship into existence. One phone call at a time. So I believe that it's no exaggeration to put him in that founder role.
No, it's not at all. I mean, you know, Ron, the thing that is really, it struck me a lot is, I mean, I can think of three interviews that Chris and I did, Jim N out of Nebraska, Roy P out of Philadelphia, and Joe P out of Memphis, you know, and all have said that they tried to start meetings there and they folded, and they were at a point where it was like, I'm going to pack up and move to L.A. because that's where meetings are. Mm. And they called Jimmy and talked about it, and Jimmy said, no, you stick and stay there and start meetings. And it's that type of spirit right there that Jimmy had that really and truly spread this message. And him talking to you, Ron, in Fargo. I know a man down, D.H., down in Greenville, South Carolina, that was among the first three people at the NA meeting in 1980 at the Clean and Green Group. And Dee would call him. Actually, Jimmy was Dee's sponsor. And it's that type of spirit, that type of commitment that shepherding is the correct word.
Yeah, I was thinking about how I regarded it at the time. It's kind of hard to get it in focus, but I was, you know, like I said before, I was young. I was a bit cocky. We were doing some, you know, the reason that I called Jimmy, if you want to know the truth, more than any other reason, wasn't because I thought, oh, here's my opportunity to talk to the founder. That wasn't it. It was, if we order our literature on a piece of paper on the order form, we may or may not ever get that literature. If we order, and we may get it twice. And we used to joke about that. My friend Willie and I was like, well, if we're going to get our literature, we're going to have to get on the phone and talk to this guy. Because when you talk to him, he sits right there and kind of fills out the form for you, and he trusts you to send in the money, and he'll send you the literature. And that was the best way to get the literature. And so we'd end
up, that's great.
We'd end up in these conversations with Jimmy, not really realizing, you know, and we would joke because he was a talker. I mean, Jimmy was a talker. He would get going, and he would talk and talk and talk. And so it was like, well, if you're going to order literature, you better have a little time on your hands, because you get Jimmy going and he's going to make sure you're clued in on all the various aspects of what you need to do.
The whole issue of founders is a fascinating one. It's fascinating with Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always kind of enjoyed the way that Bill W. would kind of redirect, much like Jimmy would, and say, you know, there are many founders. You know, there are many people that played such a critical role in this that any number of us had been called founders. And I think it's an interesting thing that, you know, we kind of get into when we look at that. I tend to, when we're introducing Jimmy, to describe him as one of the early founders who really shepherded, you know, I don't know if I use the word shepherded, you just used it, but he's one of the early founders who really, you know, brought NA back to life and, you know, made all these significant contributions. There's a guy that I was talking with recently who kind of just made an observation about, you know, how is Bill W. and Dr. Bob going to be looked at in 100 years from now, in 200 years from now? And kind of almost the farther, the more distance that goes on, the more likely that this founder and co-founder role can be kind of elevated up into almost like a religious type of idolization of people. And I thought that was kind of an interesting point, the way that we think about those people and how time kind of influences the perception of it. And that may be this, you may edit this whole thing out probably.
No, this is the good stuff as far as I'm concerned. I think that's a really fascinating point. And the founders tend to get rehumanized again by certain stories. Like, Bill Wilson has had so many biographies written about him now, and the one I found the most interesting and enjoyable to read was the one that was written by Lois's personal secretary in about the year 2000, I think. I don't remember for sure, but it was the foreword to the book said it was Lois's personal secretary, and it was the one where they went into Bill, how much of a smoker he was and how much of a womanizer he was. And that's when really they broke the stuff about him having been involved in the LSD experiments that were going on at a university. And so he had several times taken LSD, which gets thrown around in a cavalier way. I don't think it's entirely fair the way that gets characterized sometimes, but anyway, there's an effort to rehumanize those kind of deified founders. And I think the same is true and will be true of Jimmy. Jimmy was very much a human being. There's no doubt about it. He was full of a passion and willingness and commitment, and he made this you know, all the things we were just saying, he made it happen. But he also could get very combative. And when I went to work for the World Service Office, a guy that I was working directly with at the time had been Jimmy's assistant at the office for a period, for quite a while. And I know Bob Stone had told me too that it was a complete mess. I mean, when he went in to try to figure out how to, you know, where are we in terms of filling orders and that sort of stuff, there was absolutely no way to tell, which is consistent with what I was just saying. You'd order literature, you may or may not get it. You may get it twice. There was no system there. And Jimmy, I mean, Bob opened up drawers, and in those drawers were order forms with checks that were months or even a year or more old. And Bob was just flabbergasted. It's like, why are these sitting in this drawer? And Greg told me later that Jimmy had such strong personality clashes with certain people and out there in the fellowship that if he would get a order form from somebody and he would say, Jimmy would say, just throw that in the drawer. We're not filling that one. I mean, he would just literally blackball certain people from their literature because they were objectionable to him. And Jimmy was not the only member in that period, especially in the 70s. He wasn't the only member who ran the World Service Office, such as it was at the time. I know that Jack B. sometimes was in that role of kind of holding down the fort while Jimmy was in the hospital. I know that Bob B. was also, you know, the ongoing joke was the World Service Office is actually Bob B.'s trunk of his car where the literature sits, and you order your literature, and if you're close enough, he'll drive and deliver it to you, kind of thing. It's sort of like we think of area now, and NA wasn't all that much bigger than that back then.
And you probably hit the nail on the head right there, Ron.
Yeah.
The other, you know, another contribution that Jimmy made was the NA symbol. And a couple things reminded me of that. One, you mentioned him and his hospitalizations for tuberculosis. But it leads to this other thing that was interesting was some of the other outside influences upon Jimmy. And one of which was a book by David Stewart called Thirst for Freedom that was published in 1960. And you can start seeing some things in that book that really kind of, you can see the influence of them on Jimmy and some of the things he contributed. In Thirst for Freedom, the author writes, with this new basic philosophy, the new AA member sets about to render his life around four main ideas: the self, society, service, and God. And so you see that come up in our four-sided NA symbol of self, society, service, and God. And the other thing that you see in the Thirst for Freedom book is stuff that appears in the IP Another Look that was written by Jimmy Kay. And in Thirst for Freedom, it says, though we cannot say precisely what addiction is, we can say what it is not. And addiction is not a way of life, although it may appear to be. And then in the IP Another Look, Jimmy writes, if we can find greater agreement on what addiction is not, kind of the opposite view, then perhaps it may appear with greater clarity.
Hmm. Well, he also, in David Stewart, in the book Thirst for Freedom, uses the term freedom from active addiction, which is a term that found its way into Jimmy's writings. I'm not sure exactly where, but I know it's in the basic text.
Well, it's found its way into real popularity in our fellowship now with the expression, we have only one promise.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
But I always took that in part as we only have one promise, blah, blah, but also we're not AA. they have so many, you know.
They have so many promises.
That's
yeah.
Right. We don't waste a whole bunch of promises. I don't know. Sometimes I think some of those little cultural things, especially back in the I would say early to mid 80s is where there was just a lot of attempt to distinguish ourselves from AA and do things differently and note the differences.
Let me throw this out. I always say that I owe my life to the fact that the Little White Book, which was given to Roy, he claimed by Jimmy, ended up in the rehab that I was in 5 years after that book arrived, and there were NA meetings there. But I'm not sure that there's been enough discussion about how derivative, frankly, our basic writings truly are, that they are borrowed greatly from both the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 and 12, and the AA culture that existed in the 50s, and through researching various phrases that have worked its way into our culture through the AA Grapevine digital archive. I mean, it's just very clear. You look at Jimmy's recovery and relapse, it's lifted directly from Bill Wilson's essay, Emotional Sobriety. So I guess I have no problem with thinking of him as one of the prime co-founders, if you will, and certainly the prime motivator of the fellowship as we know it, especially with the emphasis on publishing and getting the word out. I mean, it's just incredibly admirable, that kind of dedication. I get stuck a little bit on the term founder, both for the tendency it is to overlook the fact that the word was put into popularity, I believe, out of the East Coast Fellowship in New York City, and also the fact that there were so many other people involved in the early meetings. Clearly, Jimmy emerged, you know, from 60 on as the prime guy. But I just get a little stuck on the term founder.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the culture of NA. I think it really is that there is a little ambiguity around around the founding of NA. A little ambiguity because of the history that came before it, out of which it was a derivative, and because of the people involved, that there was a number of people involved. Also because in that personality clash between Jimmy and Cy, Cy claimed to be the founder, and Jimmy ultimately stepped away, came back in 1960. So I think there's always going to be an asterisk by that term in NA.
Right. Like, to me, to admire him the way that I do, I don't need the word founder attached to him.
Exactly.
There's so many other qualities about him, which, as I, to repeat, of my life to that Little White Book, ending up here and the fact that there was a meeting 3 miles from where I sit tonight because of his emphasis on publishing and getting the word out.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that the point that you made about certain pieces of our literature, like, you know, in How It Works, they say, many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." And we say, "It sounds like a big order. I can't do it all at once." I mean, we found ways to rephrase things. One of my favorites is the beginning of the traditions. It is an absolute exact lift of a Bill Wilson Grapevine article where he says, "We keep what we have only with vigilance," except he said, "We keep what we have only with vigilance. And just as freedom for the individual comes from the 12 steps, so freedom for the group springs from our traditions. As long as the ties that bind us together are stronger than the forces that would tear us apart, all would be well." And I did not know that, but in 1986, when we were revising the Little White Book, I actually made the case for something like that, because I thought, isn't that a little odd? The ties that would tear us apart. I thought that was a strange phrase. The trustees discussed it and kind of came to the conclusion that we could have ties to other things. In other words, we could have this multiplicity of ties to disparate things that our sixth tradition and our tenth tradition warn us against. And so that the ties that would tear us apart is a perfectly fine phrase. And I guess I was persuaded. But I just found it interesting that it caught my ear before I knew that it was actually, that Bill's original actually said the forces that would tear us apart.
You have a great memory for certain things, and you've raised a number of things that have really just been very interesting to hear and very interesting observations. That's not one that I had thought about or heard about or recalled.
Well, there's so many of those little ones. Like I find the fifth tradition, the AA fifth tradition says each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The NA tradition says each group has but one primary purpose, to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. Now, that I find that to be an interesting little distinction. AA has a little bit different sense of autonomy than NA does, that each group has its message. And in NA, each group has the message. And, you know, you ask an NA member, what is the message? They'll tell you, that an addict, any addict, you know, and they'll run it down. That is the message of NA. And AA is more like, more its message. And there's when AA groups do things like decide to meet at the university and not be on the schedule and they call themselves an AA group, that kind of stuff doesn't seem to stir up anything in AA. That's like, okay, but in NA, it's like you're stepping away from the fold kind of. It makes us nervous. Or if a group decides not to come to area, we don't have the same sense of autonomy that they have. And that showed up in the international development too, where AA granted a lot of autonomy to the international fellowship with a separate service conference and a separate office and a separate board of trustees in various continents, where NA made the decision to have a single program worldwide. And I don't think we've ever regretted that, but we struggle with it a bit. Like right now, we're trying to have a worldwide World Service Conference that is growing and growing and growing, and we can't figure out how to reconstitute the representation at the World Service Conference to make it still be one single worldwide entity and yet not grow to an unmanageable size. So I just think some of those little cultural distinctions where we've, you know, you hear people say one disease, one program, right? People are very interested in the unity of the whole, where the its message stuff and AA, they seem to be more okay with it taking different forms in different places.
Before we leave the topic, I just want to tell you that I've spent a great deal of time deconstructing our major writings and tracing their origins to AA literature, and I'm looking at it. It needs to be typed by my secretary, but I'll get it out to all of you as soon as it is.
Do you have any other interesting examples off the top of your head?
Oh, my God. Just about every major writing. No, I don't have that kind of memory, but I've done quite a bit of the writings. Why don't you talk about something else, and I'll just look at
it. Well, I'm thrilled to see this, Dave, because I'd started something called Comparison of Passages from the Big Book and the Basic Text. And, you know, one of the things that stood out to me is in the Big Book, it says, now we need more action, without which we find that, quote, faith without works is dead. And then I look at the Basic Text, words mean nothing until we put them into action. And maybe I'm seeing things that aren't there, but I love kind of looking for those influences and those similarities.
Oh, I do it all the time. I'm addicted to it. I have the concordance on my iPad. I check it all the time. The AA Big Book Concordance. just a couple I've jotted down the last couple of days. We do recover NA. Big Book, any alcoholic can recover. Big Book, slowly over a period of time. Basic Text 61, slowly over a period of time. Of course, Live and Let Live, Basic Text. Freely Given, Big Book, page 14. Basic Text, Freely Given, page 49. I mean, Bitter Ends, you know, that great saying, to the end of the road, the Basic Text. Big Book refers to it as the bitter end. It's practically every phrase that we consider to be NA comes directly from me.
With the exception of you can't save your ass and your face at the same time.
I'll find it. But The one I've had a trouble with is more will be revealed. The closest it comes is page 164 in the big book that says more will be disclosed.
I didn't realize that. I thought more, well, you know, when I first read the basic text, I was quite a big book thumper at the time. I knew my big book really chapter and verse by then. I was like 3 years close. And so I saw the big book all over the basic text, but I thought, oh, very, very well done in the way that it sort of took the phrases as they have been sort of enculturated and digested in NA and found their own form and then fed them back to us in a way that could now become our own brand, you know, our own culture without directly mimicking.
Absolutely. And that's what I love about it. That's why I'm such a basic text fan. I just love the book because it took proven spiritual principles written by a great poet that we know Bill Wilson to be and adapted them to our uses. I love it.
Hey, Ron, you said something, I think last time we talked, you quoted Bill Wilson around something with the traditions. I love the way that it sounded, and I can't for the life of me remember exactly what it was that you...
It was the phrase, they were hammered out on the anvils of bitter experience. And he said it over and over and over and over in his... when he did that train ride kind of thing through the country and gave all of his talks when they were kind of selling the traditions to the fellowship. Because I've listened to that whole series of tapes, and on just about everyone, he'll use that phrase when he's starting to talk about how the traditions were formed.
And I love the way that Bill talks, you know, the expressions he utilizes and so forth. I mean, they're impactful today, and you don't hear people talk like that. Mm-hmm. When we hear him describe Dr. Tom from Shelby, he describes him as a person who had to start way behind the line. And you get this image of a race, and one guy's lined up, you know, 15 meters behind the rest of the group. And it's just, it is fascinating.
Yeah, well, even some of his phrasing in the big book, like a chilling vapor that his loneliness settled down. You know, I mean, come on. You gotta love that. And stuff like the four hideous horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Yeah, baby. I miss some of that good old AA religion.
Okay, we'll get back on track, I promise. In the next Boyd and Chris episode of the Recovery Cast.
I think we're having more fun than we intended to now.
Yeah, because I'm not reading dates.